of March, and President of Representative Bernard Davidson Ellison Donnelly. The first matter on agenda is House Bill 392, Municipal Procurement of Architectural Engineering and Land Surveying Services. And prime sponsor, Representative Ellis, is here with us. Representative Ellis will be up to the committee on this legislation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this before you. 392 is an act relating to municipal procurement of architectural engineering and land surveying services. And as members will remember, last year the state of Alaska changed its procurement code in the way that we deal with design professionals. And that was in response to federal legislation that had been in place for some time. And now House Bill 392 would essentially extend that philosophy of selection to local communities unless they choose to opt out of the way that we select design professionals. In a sense, I'd like committee members or suggest that we think of this as local hire for design professionals, in the sense that points are given in the selection process for having experience working in the Alaskan climate and environment. So Alaskan design professionals would receive more points if they're experienced Alaskan design professionals than someone competing for the same contract from outside. Under the proposed statute, a municipality, as I mentioned before, would have the ability to exempt itself wholly or in part from the requirement of AS 3630-270, the state statute from last year, by adopting an ordinance that establishes a selection process. We don't say what it has to be, but if they decide not to be under the state selection process, just to come up with one of their own and put it in place. And so there's essentially freedom of choice and a local opt-out for communities. In committee members' packets, there's a resolution 88-37 of the Alaska Municipal League, which was adopted last November at their annual convention in support of this legislation. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I know there are members here or other people in the audience who would like to testify on the bill.
Okay. First person signed up to testify is Richard Ryder.
Ryder.
Just try to stand at the table, state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is Richard Ritter. I'm Chairman of Legislative Affairs for the State Chapter of the American Institute of Architects and also a member of the Alaska Professional Design Council Legislative Affairs Committee. And I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. This type of legislation was passed last year as Senate Bill 204 and also as part of the procurement bill that was passed. And it basically was passed because the process is simple and fair, and it's been chosen by the federal government and many other states, and is primarily used by a lot of municipalities in the state already. When we first introduced that bill, we had included municipalities in the bill, and at that time, the Municipal League did not feel comfortable with that, and so they desired that they not be included, and so as a compromise, we agreed that they should be taken out. As Representative Ellis pointed out, they passed at their last convention in November. They decided that they would like to advise their different members to procure architectural engineering services in that manner, the same manner that many others do. And so they passed a resolution unanimously, I believe, stating that they would support that. So we're basically here to say that we would like to see that go through, and we support the bill as it currently is in writing.
Okay, any questions for the witness?
Yes, let me make sure I understand. Currently, the statute reads that the procurement office shall negotiate. I recall it Form 254, Form 255.
Yes, those are federal forms that indicate your qualifications.
Right. And as I recall, let me back up. You mentioned last year that the legislation passed. Was that signed,
yes.
Vetoed, or what?
It actually passed in two different places. It passed as part of the procurement code and also as Senate Bill 204. And I don't believe Senate Bill, actually I believe both went through, so there's actually,
okay. Right.
Both were signed by the government.
Now, what's the difference between what statute provides under 3630-270 versus what you anticipate under this legislation with the municipality setting up its own process?
Oh, if the municipality wanted to set up their own process?
Right.
That basically was a compromise with the Municipal League. They did not feel comfortable with the idea of forcing different municipalities to follow this legislation. They felt there should be a chance for them to opt out if they wanted to do so. And we agreed that was a fair idea. So I think all they've got to do is pass an ordinance that indicates that that they will have a different selection process, and that's important to us because it makes them think about the selection process they're using. And I don't think it will be a complicated matter to opt out, but at least they'll have thought about their selection process.
Again, I'm still looking for the difference. Are you looking for a different selection process through a municipal ordinance than what the state has set up now?
Yes, if they want to do something different, yes, then they can opt out under this legislation.
Now, I'm mindful of several years ago, the competitiveness of your profession, for example, was judged unconstitutional. There was a big constitutional battle for many years. I know back in 83, 84, we tried to do the same thing, and it was declared unconstitutional. And I'm wondering, are you familiar with that issue?
I vaguely remember DOT had some suggested fee curves. Is that what you're speaking of? That was
no,
declared.
It had to do with the actions of the lack of competition. Let me see if I can frame it, Mr. Chairman. As I recall, under the present statute, you're basically judged based upon the 254 to 255, which is sort of the history of a project that you had before, and it was generally felt that there was a need for more competition in that not only would those two documents be the determinant, that a new firm, for example, a new person should be able to compete on an equal basis, and a firm with a long history with an extensive 254, 255 would provide, say, unfair competition.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and so therefore, I believe on the federal level and on the state level, it was judged to be, D.C. Attorney General Gorsuch had held that the legislation was unconstitutional, and it was vetoed by, I suspect, Governor Hamlin. I'm wondering that we're getting back into that battle again.
Yeah, I'd have to say I recall what you're talking about vaguely, and I believe that the issue was resolved when the procurement bill was passed, also the Senate bill 204, because I recall vaguely that did come up. I don't remember the specifics of that issue, though.
Well,
if there were discussions in that.
President Copeland, can you lighten us?
Yeah, the problem was that under the old procurement system of the federal government, they made a distribution and gave points to groups that had been with us for a long time, and that did act in that way. And it also tied in to the recommendations, as I remember, of the professional boards themselves, so that in a way they were delegating some of the authority to the professional board, which is not a constitutional delegation of power on the one hand, on the other hand, allow the professional board to act in constraint of trade, or it was so considered. And this would then solve what was called the Brooks Amendment, which was put into the federal legislation. And we, and I think 204, adopted what we call the Mini Brooks Amendment, and that was also written into the procurement code. So this is in line with the solution to that problem. This doesn't call for using the no longer existing procurement policy, which was, as you point out, found to be unconstitutional and in constraint.
Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Richard, on the small communities, or small or large, what have the they can opt out of this if they want, yes. And they have to set up a selection process of their own. Is there any requirements to that selection process? Does it have to follow the similar to the state procurement code, or can they develop, or what are the guidelines on that?
My understanding is they can do whatever they want. That was part of the compromise with the municipal league. They knew that there were communities that had their own procurement processes. They can opt out of this merely by passing that process as part of their ordinance. And I don't think the legislation will prevent them from having even the simplest ordinance passed. They wanted to. That's my understanding, at least.
And one more question. Then in some areas, and I don't know whether it would happen or not, but you might have some small community out somewhere that if this legislation passes and stuff, they don't get the word that this is in and they go forward with a project or something that doesn't follow this. Then what is the repercussions that come down, or do you see that as a problem at all?
I suppose it could be a problem. In the past when that's happened, there was one community in the South East that ran into that about several years ago, and they were notified, they had put out a proposal request, and they're notified by architects that this didn't meet the state law, and so they waited a couple months and put it out differently. So I that's probably what happened to them, is they'd be delayed in their project.
But you wouldn't foresee that a community would put out a project and they go forward with the project and get halfway through it or something?
I don't think, though, that's already happened to a certain extent. And usually by that time, there's no point served by it. No one's benefited served by going after on that. I'm not sure who would go after them. I don't think the architects and engineers would have the horsepower or finances to cause any problems.
I didn't know who was in the department, administration, or someone like that.
Probably have to be the Attorney General's office that would have to do something about it if they felt it was a serious violation.
But you don't see it as a problem?
Probably not, no, probably not. One thing, the legislation does allow a small community to do anything they want if the fee is less than $25,000. And that covers quite a bit of ground for a small community. And that was put in there for DOT's benefit, because DOT uses a term contract process where they have two or three architectural engineering firms online. They have contracts negotiated at the beginning of the year, and they use them to sort of rotate through them for fees less than $25,000 on small contracts that lets them do them efficiently without going through an RFP process every single time.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman. Sir, you indicated this would be a simple fair matter after we pass this legislation, and I guess I want to know simple and fair to whom. It seems like it's more fair to architects than anyone, and I can understand the intent, but where's the problem right now?
I think the difficulty is, I think in the long run, communities and agencies are better served if they select based on qualifications. And they certainly have the option to negotiate with the firm they feel is most qualified. If the fee is too high, they certainly can go to the second firm, to the third firm. That has been done if the price is a problem. And I think when you select, Maryland for about 10 years had a process based on CARE bid for professional services, and they discovered after that time that the staff and paperwork required to put out a true bid for professional services was more costly than using qualifications-based processes other states and the federal government did. I think what happens is, as some communities and agencies, they believe incorrectly that they can put out a proposal, a bid proposal, for example, and provide us complete architectural services to design the school, and they think that's good enough. And in fact, that doesn't even begin to tell us what the base RFP is. And that's been our biggest complaint. And I think if the community ends up with, if you select architects based on price, you may get a good one. You may get one that's not qualified. I think if you select based on qualifications, you have a better chance of getting a well-qualified firm that will do the project properly. And you also have the opportunity to negotiate with them towards a fee that's fair. And if you can't reach that agreement with the first firm on your list, then you go to number two. I'd have to say that my experience has been if a municipality has four or five firms on a short list, for example, probably any one of them would do a good job on the project. So,
if I may continue. So what size municipality would you have in mind here? All municipalities, first and second class cities, or just who do you think should be following this new procurement requirements?
I think that the way the bill stands right now, it's my understanding that all municipalities, no matter how small, would follow this. I believe there's some language in the committee substitutes concerning home rural communities, which would go down to the very smallest communities, is my understanding.
So what kinds of individuals would this bill cut out of the picture?
In what manner?
Well, apparently there's going to be some people who will qualify with their qualifications and others who will not.
Actually, I was thinking about that before I came in a little bit. The state law does not require that you have an exotic selection process. And the way I understand the law, if a small community knew of an architect that they felt was well qualified to do the job, they could just give them a call. That's my understanding. Now, you might want to check that with legal advice. So my feeling, the way I read the bill, would be that the community would not have to go through a big proposal request process if they didn't want to. Right now, some small communities do that. Communities like Petersburg and Randall, I don't know if they have called up a firm that they know is qualified to do a job and is negotiated directly. And I don't believe that would be against the law. You would probably want to check that, but I'm not, well, not a legal expert.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if I can continue just briefly. I do have concerns about the smaller communities, unincorporated in areas that have these smaller projects, and I think that this is going to produce yet another hoop for them to pass through to get some small capital project accomplished. So I'd still like to hear more testimony on the bill. And
okay, Representative Lennard, then Representative Copeland.
Mr. Chairman, are there more people to testify? Okay. Richard, on this, now, if there is a small community like Representative Davidson is talking about, today, right now, are there communities that are doing projects without hiring an architect, that are doing small projects? And by passing this legislation, would this require these small communities? I'm trying to figure out the problem on this.
Yeah, based on my experience, I don't think there is a problem with communities not hiring skilled architects. I think one problem I can mention is that it's fairly common. I don't have any specific examples to mind, but it's fairly common for groups to call an architect in Seattle or Tacoma, for example, because their prices are cheaper. There's no doubt about it. They're just cheaper. They're probably 5/8 of the cost of the last architect. Their overhead is lower. We have been aware. I remember one project. Well, there was a project in Pelican, I believe. It was in addition to a building that we had designed originally. We found out about after the fact they were using a firm from Tacoma to do the addition. And I believe they were registered in the state. But I think that there's a couple of issues. I think they'd be well advised to at least look at qualifications. They probably called up a firm that, and I have never even heard of the firm, they're probably less expensive and they probably save some dollars. But the native building over on Willoughby, they called, that's not a municipality or state agency, of course, but they called an architect from Seattle directly and got a good price to the building. I got a call from that architect a couple of years later. They were having ice banding problems in the roof, and they wanted to know as an Alaskan architect if I had any suggestions for how to solve the problem. So there are, I think a community is at least well advised to consider qualifications. I think the process is actually fairly straightforward. Should not be a big paperwork burden. I don't think the bill requires them to have an exotic RFP process, and a community would be well advised under any case to look at qualifications of firms and seriously consider if they want to just take a cheap price from a firm out of Oregon or Washington or Montana even.
I can hear you on that point, and I agree.
Does that answer your question?
Well, just the fact that communities, no matter what the project is that we're trying to discuss here, are hiring architects now, if I understand you, of some form, whether they're hiring them outside or within or not, they are hiring architects to do these projects.
Yes. Now, to be completely fair, there are also examples where they have a selection process and they select based on qualifications and they end up with a firm out of state. That happens too. It depends on what kind of project it is. So if it's a highly technical, specialized project, there may not be any architects in the state who are qualified. That's possible, certainly.
Okay. Representative Copeland and Representative Curtis.
Well, we have
a number of floating variables here and there. Some of them have been floated. What is generally the least expensive building for which an architect is called in? Some community building.
For a community building? Oh, probably like a storage building or something like that, warehouse space.
About what price range?
Well, if you had $500,000 storage building, which would be a pretty big one, I suppose you'd be paying an architect around 5 or 6%.
So we're essentially talking a contract that are above $500,000, and there are many of the smaller communities, like, many of them are 200 odd small rural isolated communities have to consider how many of them are going to have a $500,000 building that their local council is going to be in charge of, or whether they're going to go to the catalog of what we're building, let us say, and say, oh, that looks like a nice one, and buy that. In other words, the pre-manufactured, pre-built things they'll drop on the lot. And those things don't necessarily come under this, so that's one. And
so that you have this variable about how much is being spent, what is being spent for, how large, what is the capacity of the community to oversee any project. We're probably mixing apples and oranges very much and assuming that every project is going to have an architect attached to them in the planning process. The other thing that I remember from the previous discussion, which is the problem with the open bid process, is put out a simple bid and you say, design us a building, the low bidder can come back to the plant for an outhouse and let you be a little more specific. The greater specificity you have, the more work you're going to have to do beforehand. In other words, you're going to have to design the building for the architect practically. You're going to put up, this is why we got away from it, because this allowed for the process of negotiation. So essentially, I believe the bill allows the municipalities in a small enough building to do it without an architect, especially if it's a pre-designed package, that kind of thing. And in the case of larger buildings, when they have a specific purpose, it allows them then to negotiate with the architects and begin to develop, make it more clear than you can in an ordinary bid document as to what it is you really want and where you want it. You can't take a stock plan for a building and put it either on a steep mountainside like that around here or put it in the swamp with the settlement. You have to adapt the building to the location.
Actually, a better example might be a roof repair. We replaced a roof in Pelican. It was about $125,000 worth. I think our fee was about $8,000. That's far below the $25,000 cap that allowed them to do anything they please, basically.
Who's in first?
Oh, thank you, Chairman. Richard, I have a couple of concerns. One, I think this issue is almost like the creation evolution issue in education. That's a valuable enough fight because there's different opinion. I think if you check the record, I may have been the sponsoring legislator of the change of the law back with the 13th legislature that basically put in statute your ability to compete based upon qualification. You can't use the 254 and 255s as a documented experience. It appears that what we may be doing here, at least a potential, we may be turning the clock back on that whole argument. And in my opinion, it has nothing to do with low bidder, it has nothing to do with the qualification of the size of the projects or all those kinds of things. It has to do basically with that competitive environment. And the municipality could probably, the best course of action would be for them to adopt the statute under 36-3270, and at least somewhat settle the issue, at least in this state, and stop at least the Attorney General from harassing. It appears to me what we may be doing by letting the municipalities come up with an ordinance, if they are not sensitive to the history of this issue, you may be opening up a can of worms again and put yourself back in the courts. Now, I guess, Mr. Chairman, my concern with that, I don't think we've done a homework. I would really like to go back to Bob Maynard, for example, who was active in this with us before, and get a briefing as to where we've come from with this issue and make sure we're doing the right thing. Granted, the legislation basically has nothing to do with the state of Alaska, and that we're passing certain abilities on to municipalities. But before we agree to that, we ought at least have some history as to what this issue is about. And I'm convinced at this table the issue is not the proper frame to make that decision. That would be my concern. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Any further questions for the witness? Thank you for your testimony, sir.
Thank you.
Is there any member of the public that's not signed up that would like to testify? Okay. For discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Representative Furnish, you're saying that there's another statute that would take care of this that's on the book?
No, I'm saying the current statute is a compromise that was reached after many, many years. The architects and engineers have been before the legislature to try and get some clarification in statute as to how projects were to be at least procured or appropriated, and that before, as I recall, it was generally considered a discriminatory practice or unfair practice to do it any other way. What they'd always wanted was to be able to be judged based upon qualification. Well, needless to say, that cuts out a certain tier of professionals, those who have not been part of a large firm and have developed a long history on certain kinds of projects. The language and statute was worked, was a real close compromise that was able to pass constitutional muster and get the AG off their back a couple of years ago. We seem to be opening that door again to bring this whole issue back. What I'm suggesting is we bring the AG guys back in, principally I think with Bob Maynard at that time, and have him brief the committee as to the history of this issue, and then we'll have a little bit more information to go on and determine if this is something we're going to be doing. That's my recommendation.
Representative Ellis?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't understand Representative Furness's point. A history lesson might be a beneficial thing, but the legislation is quite simple in its intent, and that's to take what Representative Furness, I guess, played a role in putting in place in terms of going from low bidder to a qualification-based selection system, and extending that to subdivisions of state government. After the federal government decided it was a good path to take, the state decided that more recently, and this bill would simply extend what we've done, and I guess according to Representative Furness has withstood constitutional muster, and extend it to local communities, and the local communities who would come under this are the ones who choose to do so, or choose not to opt out. So I don't think it's all that complicated what this bill is all about. In terms of, I know Senator Zaroff, whose staff is here in the room, has expressed a concern as bills have moved through both bodies that that some smaller local communities make use of the force accounting system as their process for selection of design professionals. Whether that's the selection method used at the local level on large state projects that the state treasury is providing the money for, whether it be a local project, we're not telling anyone that they don't have freedom of choice in this. But if force accounting with local people is the preferred method at the local level, then all they need to do is to state that in an ordinance. It could be probably not more than two or three lines on a piece of paper, so everybody knows the rules of the game at the local level, regardless of the size of the community, just so everybody has a process. I personally think that the one that that previous legislature put in place, Representative Furness worked on, is a very good one. And we're giving subdivisions of the state the ability to operate under that, and if they choose not to do so, if they choose to take any other selection method, they're free to do so. So I think the issue is very simple, and there's nothing in this bill, frankly, that changes what has gone before and the selection process the state operates under now.
Mr. Chairman.
President Furness.
I hate to disagree, but Representative Ellis, if you read your bill, you note here that the municipalities are currently covered under existing statutes. What this legislation basically says is if you don't agree with this or choose to follow the existing statute, that you can set up any process that you deem necessary. That's the portion that I have problems with. They can set up any process that they deem necessary in order to carry out their local wishes. Now, you speak of force accounting, I believe, and I don't have time to research it in the statute. There was considerable discussion of force accounting, particularly in rural communities, and the problems that were involved there. And as I recall, because the state of Alaska basically made available those monies and did certain audits of those projects, that there was some at least implied exemption when it came to force accounting kinds of projects. They had to indeed comply with that selection criteria. But there was considerable discussion as to how to handle it and be sensitive to the needs of those entities using force accounting. Your bill basically tells municipalities, if you don't like the state statute, go out and on an ordinance, adopt your own process.
Representative Ellis?
Well, Representative Furness, what the legislation says, if the municipality or the local community does not want to operate under the same system the state does, they can continue with their current method of selection. We're not directing them to go out and change their method of selection. If they opt out, they can. All they have to do is just pass an ordinance, a single sheet of paper in many cases, and continue with their current selection process. That would be the practical effect of opting out of this legislation. So, I don't see how we're really disagreeing there at all. I guess the only thing we would disagree on is that whether that's a problem or not. But if your point is that current selection processes under which local communities now operate are illegal or unconstitutional in some way, then that's a problem that I guess you might want to alert the Attorney General to go after some small communities. But that's not what I intend.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm too new in this process, but I have yet to see any legislation that's simple.
Thank you.
And if we're going to leave it wide open, as the representative maker suggests, I mean, why is it necessary in the first place? And if we're going to let people do just what they're doing now, or pass anything they want to pass, why is this necessary?
Well, I'll take that as a question to the representative from downtown, Representative Ellis.
Well, I think it's necessary because I believe qualification-based selection for architects, engineers, and land surveyors is in the public interest. I think it's a superior selection process, and I think local communities would be well advised where they believe it's in their community's best interest to take advantage of it. Now, we're talking about, in many cases, public facilities. Now, if we're talking about storage sheds for the local municipality or something like that, I can see where it might not be the wisest path. But when we're talking about schools or community centers or recreational facilities where citizens and children congregate, then I think it's very important, and especially because much of the money that's spent in large communities and small rural communities are state dollars, that belong to all of us. And when those monies are parceled out all across the state, and I'll be the first to admit they're not always fairly distributed across the state, but when they do go out for public purposes, I think it's incumbent on local office holders, local communities, to make sure that those public facilities are designed in the best way possible, and that's with qualified people. Now, there are some examples, and maybe Richard has some horror stories that he might be able to relate, design jobs that were done before the state had the current procurement code in place, where non-qualified people did the design work, or were the low bidders. Maybe they were qualified, but they were the low bid. They cut corners, they didn't do the job they should, and the roof caved in on the school. Now, in one case that I can think of, there were no kids in that school at the time, but if there had been, there would have been a multi-million dollar lawsuit, class action suit on the part of a lot of parents against the Anchorage School District, and there would have been a lot of dead kids. That's an extreme example, but it occurred in the state of Alaska, and there may be other examples that I'm not as familiar with. But I think that's the compelling reason why qualification-based selection is a superior process to low bidder. Now, if local communities have other things that they're more comfortable with and want to take that chance, or they've got a good system in place, that's great, and they can opt out. That's why I think it's necessary.
Okay, Representative Copeland and Representative Furness.
Well, lacking the opt-out language, it could possibly be argued that the state procurement code operates in every case where state monies are used. In other words, without this language, small communities would be forced to, or could be forced to, by legal action, not by court action, by somebody taking a complaint to court, be forced to use the state procurement procedure. So, that's one side. The other is, of course, that when you allow variations, you have to have a standard to measure from, and it's essentially the standard. Otherwise, the standard is set by what the court decides is common law, and that is something that we as a legislature have no control over. Representative Chris?
Do we have anybody from DOT or Commerce in the audience today?
Anybody from DOT or Commerce in the audience today?
Just another point, Mr. Chairman. In the legislation, facilities under the cost of $25,000 are exempted from this. And just to clarify another point, the state of Alaska, when we adopted this qualification-based selection process, we are the only division of government that operate under that currently in the state of Alaska. Municipalities do not currently come under it, so it's not, we're not making a distinction between large municipalities and smaller communities. This legislation extends the state system to other subdivisions unless they opt out. So municipalities are not currently included, and this legislation would include them unless they make a decision otherwise.
That's horrifying. Could be argued legally. All
right, well, the matter is still before us for discussion. Motions. Is it Menard? Do you have a motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if there's no further discussion, I would move HB 392 out with individual recommendations.
I think that's adopting the committee substitute?
Yes.
Okay, the motion would be to adopt the committee substitute. Is there any objection to adopting the proposed committee substitute? Okay, the committee substitute is adopted. Motions to move the bill with individual recommendations. Any objection to the motion?
Okay.
Call the question. All those in favor of the motion signify by the usual sign. 2, 3, 4. All those opposed? 2. Motion carries. The next matter on the agenda is Representative Frank is here. Would you like to join us?
Thank you.
House Bill 523, a preference for recycled projects and products in the state and municipal procurements. The proposed committee substitute from that Representative Frank's office has helped us prepare tightens the title of the bill, among other things, and that's in the members file. There was a State Affairs Committee substitute also. It has a zero fiscal note and has a further referral to the Finance Committee. Representative Frank, would you like to address the committee on this?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. As you indicated, the proposed committee substitute extends the product preference for recycled products to municipalities. And this is an idea that came to light after we got it through the state affairs. You know, the idea, well, maybe we should require the municipalities to also provide a preference for recycled products. I think some of you at least were present in the state affairs when we had testimony on the bill there, or have had benefit of other exposure to the whole idea of recycled products. To give you just a little bit of refreshment there, or to refresh your memories for those that haven't, in Fairbanks right now there is a recycling operation going. Yeah. The contractor that contracted for the borough's landfill is recycling products and will be making a full range of recycled products from municipal waste, from garbage. They'll be separating out the plastics, separating out the papers, separating out the metals and that sort of thing, and making products from the metals, not the metals so much, but the plastics and the papers, making fuel basically out of the paper products and other products out of the plastics, such as 2x4s and things like that for the plastics. And what the idea is to give the Alaska product preference to extend it to give it the statutory reference that it right now it probably does fall under the Alaska products preference. So this would just ensure that in statute, outline it in statute, allow the person to be able to point to it in statute and show the banker there, because a lot of times you have a hard time convincing a banker that you're going to be able to sell your product. And so one of the big purposes behind the bill is to outline in statute that the Alaska that a recycled product does contain the preference, does fall under the Alaska product preference. Now with the CES bringing municipalities under the requiring that they comply with the product's preference for recycled products, it goes one step further. And that is a more significant question, and one that I you know, I bring before the committee as a proposal. The concept isn't unusual. I think Representative Donnelly's bill on Alaskan bitters preference and product preference contains provisions requiring municipalities and school districts to use Alaskan products or to give a preference for Alaskan products. Senator Josephson's bill on agriculture products and fisheries products requiring the municipalities and school districts to utilize the product preference for those products is also going through the committee process. And, I wanted to keep this bill narrowly structured to just deal with recycled products, and frankly not take on the larger issue of all product preferences and bitter preferences that is the subject of Representative Donnelly's bill. And I am here, you know, I appreciate the committee's indulgence. I think it's a good idea. We haven't developed a large body of testimony or position papers from municipalities. I have checked with both of my municipalities, and they have gotten a positive initial reaction from both the mayor of the borough and the city manager. From what I understand, the municipalities haven't in general objected to the idea of a product's preference, but I don't have anything official from them on that. If the committee is so inclined to include municipalities, and you'd also like to include school districts in the products preference for recycled products, we have a prepared amendment that would include school districts as well, but not REAAs, based upon the fact that REAAs are a little smaller and perhaps less able to cope with giving a product preference. But I kind of leave it up to the committee, and I'm happy to work with the committee on any way that I want to get a sense of the body and see what you think.
There's no members of the public signed up to testify, but Mr. Link from the Department of Administration is here if needed to answer questions. Are there questions for the prime sponsor of the seminar?
Just, Mr. Chairman, Representative Frank,
yes.
Adding school districts into this, what products are you, what do you...
Well, I think the scenario that we'd be looking at would perhaps be in fuels, perhaps, although it isn't. I can envision Anchorage, for example. I can envision Anchorage moving to a municipal waste recycling, okay? And I can see them utilizing, whoever does that. I don't know whether they do it on a contracted basis like they are in Fairbanks or however, but I could see a school district, mixing in some of those fuel pellets with their coal, mixing in a small, like right now at the University of Alaska, the recycler in Fairbanks has a contract to mix in, to sell them some pellets, and they're going to mix it in like 10% or something like that with their coal. It in fact increases the BTU on their coal because it's got a lower moisture content than the coal does. So I could envision that. I could also envision if there was a new school built, or if there was a small capital project for a jungle gym or something like that out in the schoolyard, that some of these plastic 2x4s might be very appropriate for building something like that. A picnic table, those, when it'll meet specifications and work, then they have to give the preference and utilize that product.
And just familiarize myself on those pellets. Is that those paper pellets where they grind up?
Right.
Okay.
No further questions.
Are there further questions for the sponsor? Representative Copeland?
More discussion rather than questions. One of the things, of course, that happens is that this recycling increases employment in Alaska at the dumps. I think they have 6 people working for the borough, now they've got about 22 people working on recycling storage and operating the extrusion apparatus that makes these plastic posts and the like. There are a great many things that aren't done here yet, but the technology exists. For example, the archives in Mexico, when they go through old state records, they have their own pulping
machine and turn out paper that is then used by the other State Department again. So we could do that, or private enterprise in Anchorage and all different kinds of paper, they could probably do that. It's a great potential here if it's just hauled up.
Chairman, I like the idea of school districts being included.
Okay, let me test out this amendment. You can take a look at it. I have to admit that we're kind of, I wish the legal department would have been able to prepare it, but we didn't have time for them to prepare it this morning, so we took their advice and did it ourselves, their direction. I believe it will accomplish the purpose that we intend.
I do know that this legislation has a finance referral.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, what I would propose is that if the will of the committee is to adopt the CS and include the amendment, I would pledge to make sure that we got our work, you know, that we got the thing drafted properly and the amendment is properly drafted before it you know, was brought up in the finance committee.
The motion, Representative Menard?
Well, if there's no further discussion, I think it's a good idea to broaden the spectrum of it, and I would like to include the amendment in the committee substitute and make it in the form of a motion that we, adopt the committee substitute, including this motion for to include schools.
Okay. Is there any objection to the motion to adopt the committee substitute amended, as amended by the... with this amendment added to it?
No objection. I think it probably would require changing these words around and maybe the reference to boroughs. I think it probably does need to go through a redraft, but the concept is good, I think.
Okay. We'll certainly take care of that.
Well, we've got a choice here. We could just do the CS and send it to finance and let the finance committee address this if there's better language, or we can go ahead and utilize this language. Or I'm willing to adopt a conceptual amendment to do this and then let the drafters kind of fine tune this.
That'd be great.
Does anybody have any objections to that? Okay, well then the motion is to adopt a committee substitute with a conceptual amendment that deals with expanding it to school districts and then with the exception of rural education. Is there any objection to that? Seeing no objection, the motion carries and the committee substitute as amended is before us. Is there any member of the public that failed to sign up that wished to give testimony on this legislation? Representative Copeland?
We move that the CF for Hospital 253 Labor Comment be moved to the next committee referral with an official recommendation pending receipt of the CF report.
523. Is there any objection to the motion? Any no objection? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Frank.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next matter on the agenda is House Bill 540. Representative Galls.
Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask if we could take 368. I don't want to make some comments on that.
Yeah, well, Representative Galls here, too, so I'd like to
take
the
microphone. Thank you.
Call, did you wish to speak to this legislation?
Just to answer questions on the development of CS or anything I can do to serve the committee. I've got a conference committee coming up in a minute.
Let me see if there's anybody here that's sort of... Is there anybody from the governor's office or from the administration who wishes to address the committee about this legislation? Yes, there is. Would you like to sign up? He didn't say anything. He just took off.
Maybe it would be easiest, Mr. Chairman, if Steve and I both joined the
table.
Sure, welcome
to. And Peter,
Yeah, sure.
I think Red Bunch. I don't know where he is. He could just sit with us here.
You're going to be calling me up the Christmas committee, so I will try to expedite my remarks and help you expedite your work as well.
Okay. Mr. Holden, you go ahead and state your name for the record, who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Steve Holden, Department of Education. Haskell 368 was introduced at the governor's instance in our request. The purpose is to remedy a situation which occurred during the first special session, and that was the override of a gubernatorial veto on a bill which amended the occupational therapy statute. A couple of the problems created by the legislation which was enacted were, first of all, that the express language of the bill, or the legislation, prohibits a long-standing practice in school districts, and that is for licensed occupational therapists to work with school teachers and teacher aides in designing programs to implement individual education plans, which are required under federal and state law for exceptional children. Under the legislation which was enacted, that practice is now prohibited. Another problem created by the legislation is that its definition of occupational therapy is so broad as to literally prohibit anybody from doing anything which may be construed as adapting any environment for the disabled. For instance, on page 3 of the proposed CS, the definition of occupational therapy includes the work typically performed by a janitor or other person working for a school district. Sub F at the top of that page, adapting environments for the disabled for compensation is included under the definition of occupational therapy. So a janitor installing a handicapped access bar in a restroom under the express language would be prohibited from doing that. We're not wed to any particular language. That is, House Bill 368 is introduced would solve the problem that we foresee. There may be other alternatives. We have a problem, the school districts have a problem, we'd like it fixed, and we'd be more than happy to do anything we can to work with the committee or anybody else to see that gets done.
Let
me make sure I understand what's happening here. Are you speaking against the CS?
No.
In support of the original bill?
No, sir. Either do the job we need done. The proposed CS will do it, because it permits the existing practice. The bill as originally introduced will do it.
Okay, I was just going to say, Representative Curtis, that the purpose of the CS, which I guess I was sort of responsible for putting together, working with Representative Navarre's office and the chairman, was to try to eliminate any onerous passages in the governor's submitted 368 to accommodate the needs of the school districts and deal with the definitional issues raised by Mr. Moore, and do it in a fashion that met the concerns of the sponsor of the original bill, which, in a manner of speaking, generated the need for this bill. So, Representative Navarre has given his blessing to this, and for that reason, it came before the committee at this time for action. And that was just to clarify the existence of the CS.
Mr. Chairman.
I have a question to Mr. Hall. Draw your attention to subsection 6, bottom of page 1, line 27, through A, B, and A, C. Here's the question that I believe I understand, but just for the record. I may read this. Let's see. A person may not practice occupational therapy without being licensed unless the person is employed as a teacher or teacher's aide by an educational institution that requires new occupational therapy skills during the course of employment. If the occupational therapy skills are used under the program implemented by the employer and developed in consultation with a licensed occupational therapist. For the record, let me make sure. In this instance, the district is at liberty to implement a program, but it appears here that the occupational therapist is to be at least the expert in providing the assistance for the development of that program. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and the second one here, the employer maintains direct supervision of a person's use of occupational therapy skills. So, based upon the program implemented by the district in consultation with the occupational therapy, the employee employed to carry out this must be under the direct supervision. They cannot act independent.
Okay. they must, if I may, Mr. Chairman, they must implement the program designed by the occupational therapist. And only that program. They can't go beyond that scope. And
address B then, so before you maintain direct supervision of the person's use of occupational therapy skills. The district has that additional responsibility of making sure that that person is under some direct supervision.
My understanding, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is that the practical effect of this is that the teacher or the teacher's aide would be supervised from time to time by the occupational therapist to make sure that the program required is actually being implemented.
Okay. One last point, Mr. Chairman. Number C, the person does not represent to be an occupational therapist or occupational therapy assistant. I assume that the employee who has been hired under the program in A and the actual delivery of the services in B cannot take that to call themselves without proper licensure. They cannot call themselves a therapist or a therapy assistant. Is that correct?
It's correct.
The reason I asked those questions, I had a person, somebody from Anchorage called me, and they wanted these sections taken out of the bill because there appeared to have been some misunderstanding, and I wanted, just for the record, to make sure that my understanding of this section is, I'm sure the person was correct. It proves that there is no problem with it at this point, based upon this explanation.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Hall? Mr. Hall, I got a question. How closely did you work with the occupational therapist in developing legislation, original governor's bill?
The original?
Yeah.
Not at all. We circulated it among the occupational therapists. They expressed, well, I don't want to take the liberty in representing them. I spoke with one or two occupational therapists. I had the people in our department that worked with the special education folks, worked with them. We did not hear from them. It became time to introduce a bill, so we just went ahead and introduced the bill to get something in.
Well, I tell you, I heard from today, I got about a dozen phone calls from them asking me why I hated them. And I was trying to do this to them.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I received similar calls last year at the time the governor was considering a veto of the bill which created the problem. And I got calls from occupational therapists literally from all over the United States. So apparently they had concentrated a certain amount of effort on getting that bill passed. And I too was accused of less than honorable motives. And all I can tell you, Mr. Chairman, is that my only interest is in making sure that the work that needs to be done with special education youngsters gets done. And our view is that the legislation as it presently reads doesn't permit that.
I
need to go to conference committee. I'll bring it here tomorrow. We'd be happy to answer any questions that the chair may have. This was an effort to try to keep the control over occupational therapy with the occupational therapist. At the same time, when programs are developed with licensed personnel, to allow the school districts to implement their existing special ed programs, and without some language like this, those programs are going to come to a stop. So that was the justification. We did work with the occupational therapists on this. Some of them are not anxious to see an element of their turf be limited, but. I think it's clearly in the public interest to try to strike a fair balance.
There are no further questions of the witness. We have one person signed up to testify. Robin Lappin?
Everybody's got committee meetings today.
Yeah.
I didn't mind. For Davis's committee. That was our big thing for the year.
Still. Just state your name for the record, who you represent.
I'm Robin Lappin.
Did you log me in?
I'm an occupational therapist.
I'd like to.
Physical therapy and occupational therapy.
Okay, thanks, Robin. I'd like to know for the record, we represent voucher. I don't know. I've lost my quorum. These people want a teleconference. Yeah.
Two more committees in for us.
Thank you.
Please, sorry, interruption.
Well, bear with me, because it's the first time I ever have talked before.
It's okay, it's a good thing.
The other thing is,
we like that.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I just found out about this bill being presented to you last night, and I just now got something like this in front of me today, so And I just talked to one of the people from the boards, and they happened to meet, they happened to get together yesterday. So what they told me was the board, we're talking about physical therapy and occupational therapy board, they have a few concerns regarding this House Bill 368. And one of them is they basically do not think the statute and the regulatory changes should even be needed. At this point, they don't even feel that House Bill 368 is even needed. But if so, they feel that that some specific languages could be looked at and changed. And I think we talked about that a few minutes ago, the, Part 6A, we can look at that and maybe look at the, what does consultation mean? Okay, and that's
so what page are you referring to?
Page 2.
Line 2. Page 2.
Page 2,
line 2.
A, from 6, Part A. And it's in there, it talks about consultation with a licensed occupational therapist, and we are wondering what does, what do they mean by consultation? So what we're thinking of is that if you're going to go on and look at Hospital 368, then we need to look at the specific language and maybe even change it. The other thing we have some concerns is that we're quite aware that there are teacher aides in the school that are running programs, and they call it occupational therapy. So we are really concerned about what they are providing and how they are going about calling it occupational therapy. We do not want the limitation, because some of them do ADL skills and leisure activities, and do not want the limitations on the kids. Or a janitor in Grandpa and stuff too. We do not want to limit them, because they need to know they're skilled. But we want also, we really want to emphasize the fact that we can, what's needed here, we think, is educators and therapists need to be educated on how to deliver OT programs within the school while complying with the licensure law, and we're willing to work on that. And that's mainly the concerns.
Okay. I'd like to run some of these by Mr. Hull, since he's a representative of the governor in this matter. Did you have a particular, did you want to testify on the two the recommended changes of witnesses?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I got the one in sub A.
Okay.
That is that the one that was in consultation.
Okay. So staff's told me they've discussed these changes with you, and you said you could get along with page 2, line 2, the change, but page 2, line 7, you had an objection to? Amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'll make some copies
here, so
I'll
grab
the same deck. Okay, just grab a seat. The first proposed change we have no problem with. We think that those programs ought to be developed by occupational therapists rather than in consultation with them. I'm sorry, I think I missed the second one.
Okay, staff's making a copy of that for you. While you're here, Pat, does Representative Navarre wish to give any testimony on this?
He told me if it was necessary, he'd come down. He's probably just got out of UDH right now. But basically, his primary concern was to ensure that, one, the Department of Education's concerns were addressed, and two, we don't do something to undermine the professional status as occupational therapists. And those are primarily his two concerns.
Just for the record, it's Pat Malone, Representative Navarre's office. Pat, does Representative Navarre have a particular position on the proposed committee substitute? Or?
I think he feels fairly comfortable with the proposed committee substitute, Mr. Chairman, and I think he concurs that the language, proposed language change in page 2, line 2 is required. I think, if I'm not mistaken, this language was worked out due to his concern that the program is designed or developed by a licensed occupational therapist. The second language change, I think he also supports, but I'm not sure how that fits with the Department of Education's own internal regulations and federal, dealing with federal grant monies for disabled children's programs. So I think Mr. Hull is one more capable of addressing.
Okay. This is to the witness. was wondering, obviously, somebody who's working on this bill, and it seems to be a combination of Representative Navarre, Representative Goble, and the governor's office, has talked to some of occupational therapists. Are you here today to represent them officially? Mm-hmm. Okay, and they're...
I was just nominated for co-chairman of the legislative committee for the state.
Okay.
OTB association. So this is really new to me, but I'm here mainly to represent them, and they did call me on this today.
Well, I think page line two, this proposed change seems to be fairly non-controversial. If the Department of Education doesn't have a problem with it, maybe we could at least entertain a motion to incorporate that. Can we substitute the amendment from there? Representative Davidson?
So moved.
Okay. Any objection to incorporating that change? Can we substitute?
No, we're working on what the committee substitute is going to look like before we talk to you.
So now we're on to the second proposed change, which is page two, line seven. I still don't really understand what's going on with this. Mr. Hull?
Mr. Chairman, the problem arises from the fact that under federal and state law, a youngster who has been determined eligible for special education services is eligible for services under a broad range of federal and state requirements. And for a youngster who has been determined eligible, an education, individual education plan must be written. It's commonly referred to as a buzzword, an IEP. The IEP must be written by a combination of school teachers, administrators, special education service providers, that is the special ed teacher, and a parent or somebody representing the parent. The IEP lists with a great deal of specificity the services the youngster gets or is supposed to get. It deals with whatever exceptionality is present. If those services require occupational therapy, and in some cases it's that general, then the provisions of the IEP could not be carried out with this language. I wouldn't have any problem if the intent here is to make sure that the person does not represent him or herself to be something or some skill other than what exists. I wouldn't have any problem with saying, and does not represent to provide independent or unsupervised occupational therapy. Because in fact, if the services are designed by the OT, the occupational therapist, and they're monitored by the OT, then they are in fact occupational therapy services. The fact that somebody other than a licensed OT or OT assistant is doing it is a different issue. And we don't think that people who aren't occupational therapists or occupational therapy assistants ought to be representing themselves to either be those individuals or to possess those unsupervised independent skills. So if the intent is to limit the extent to which somebody can represent the skills present, then that's fine with us. We don't have any problem with that. But this would render those services incompetent with respect to the IEP.
Ma'am, do you have a response to that?
I think I'd have to talk to the people on the board and then get back with you in regard to some of that response. I myself, as an occupational therapist, I'm an infant learning specialist, and we write, as you say, IEPs, and we do transitional stages within the school district. And I've also contracted in the school district before, too. My feeling about writing those type of IEPs and the occupational therapists, and even a physical therapist, we do write programs and we go ahead and we have to have aides for teachers follow through their program, and we do, make sure that they are aware of how to do that. So I'm not sure, how that can interfere with your IEP.
That's the precise delivery service, Mr. Chairman, that we support.
Representative Menard?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I think the consensus is here that I think there is like two more committees of referral, and we hate to pass on legislation that we haven't totally finalized yet. The clock is ticking down, and I'm wondering if where we're at, we could look somewhere here before everyone runs out, is adopt a committee substitute and look at moving on with something and let them pick it up. I don't know. I'm just trying to throw out some things because of the thoughts of trying to pick this up to where when we pass this last session, when we pass something, apparently we left this loophole out there to deal with the school special ed and stuff. And I think conceptually I go ahead and support that process that we want to go ahead and look at working with this and not keeping you folks out of the loop and stuff. But I'm just thinking out loud, I guess. Before, and I know Red's getting...
How does that sound, everybody?
No.
To run out or
something. No,
how does this sound? Why don't we... I'll move at this time to amend the committee substitute to add the proposed language here on page 2, line 2, at the end of the sentence so that the entire section reads small c. The person does not represent to be an occupational therapist or occupational therapy assistant and does not represent to provide unsupervised or independent occupational therapy services. And my motion would be to incorporate that in the committee substitute. And then I'd like to, from that point, my thoughts would be to proceed to adopt the committee substitute and then bring it back up first thing probably Thursday to give these folks the time to take a look at that committee substitute and give us their opinion of that on Thursday. What does the committee think about that?
Fine.
Yeah, that sounds fine.
Okay. Oh, is there any objection to that motion then, incorporating that into the committee substitute, that language? Okay, hearing no objection, motion carries. And then I'd entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute, Representative Menard.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any objection to adopt the committee substitute? Seeing no objection, committee substitute is adopted. Now we'll get that drafted up, ma'am, and you know what it says, so we'd like you to come back Thursday and let us know exactly where your group's at on this particular language. Okay,
thank you, Mr.
All right, and we'll hold that bill over till Thursday. Next one on the agenda is House Bill 540, which is access to employee personnel files. This is a Labor and Commerce Committee bill. There's proposed committee substitute committee staff's going to explain it. Ms. Bain.
For the record, Representative Donnelly, my name is Ginger Bain, I'm the House Labor and Commerce Committee, and we have before us a typical example of the truth that was spoke earlier, that there is no such thing as a simple bill. This is a measure that was introduced by the House Labor and Commerce Committee, a simple bill that just requires that any information in a personnel file that an employer maintains shall be accessible by the employee. After filing this bill, I received several phone calls from the State Labor Relations Division and the others in the Department of Labor that expressed some concern over the measure, and also from the Department of Administration under which the Division of Personnel exists. Let me explain what the changes are in the CS. First, we have included under Section A employees and former employees. The Department of Labor called this morning and said that in their experience, the employees that very much need access to the employee files are people who have been let go from a job, and they need to know what information is in their employee file, so in case they are seeking other employment, they have some idea of what is maintained on them. So we just clarified the original version of the bill only spoke to current employees having access to their file. This is saying now the former employees also have access to the file. Secondly, in paragraph B of the bill, the original version of the bill said that it was directed at people who may maintain, quote, secret files on employees. And basically, they said you're not allowed to have a file on an employee unless the information is in their personnel file. We were notified by the Division of Personnel and Department of Labor that where an employee's permanent personnel file in the state of Alaska exists in the Division of Personnel. However, within each state agency, the supervisor maintains another personnel file. And there is sometimes temporary information put in that file of which the employee is always notified that the information is in the file. Let me give you an example. An employee is late 3 times to work. Their supervisor says, I'm putting a note in your file here in my office that you've been late 3 times. When I go to do your evaluation, if you've been late again, then I'm going to have to put some notice in your evaluation. If you're not late again between now and the time I do your evaluation, I will discard this note. All right. The way the original bill would written, it would require that employer, that supervisor, to put that note in the employee's permanent personnel file, which was not the intent here. The intent here was just to make sure that there was no file maintained on an employee that the employee didn't know about. So this has just been changed now to say that an employer can have as many files they want to on an employee as long as the employee is notified that the files exist and have access to them. Next change, Section C has been added. This was a concern in the state of Alaska. There are several collective bargaining units. some of those collective bargaining units have separate agreements about how personnel files are going to be handled. Some elements of this bill may have interfered with those. Therefore, there's a section here that simply says that nothing in this bill supersedes a collective bargaining agreement. The last change is in the last section of the bill, subparagraph 2 under paragraph D. We have expanded it to include that an employer means a person who employs one or other persons and includes the state of Alaska, the University of Alaska, the Alaska Railroad, and all political subdivisions of the state. And those are the only changes now in this committee substitute as opposed to the original version of the bill.
Okay. Ms. Bain, why do we have diligent efforts? I know that once this goes someplace else, somebody's going to ask that question. Is the department prepared to testify? What do they have an impression of what diligent efforts is?
Referring to language on page 1, line 20. That was the language that the drafter chose when we discussed whether or not somebody should just notify the employee. She felt that the original version of the bill said that if you maintained information on an employee that they did not have access to, that you could be found guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. Since it's fairly unprecedented to threaten a state supervisor with a civil offense like that, then we chose to remove that from this bill, but we still wanted to make it pretty strong language that the supervisor had better make sure that the employee is notified of any information that's being maintained on it.
Okay, so it's no longer a criminal offense.
It's no longer a misdemeanor offense.
Okay.
I move that we adopt the committee substitute.
Okay, is there any...
I've got to be moving along here, and at least I wonder why you get enough people
sure,
to do that.
Sure, I think so. Any objection to adopting the committee substitute?
Sure.
Okay, committee substitute's adopted. Gentlemen, okay, these two gentlemen are from Department of Administration, Department of Labor. Do you have any suggested changes in the legislation?
It's fine.
You like it the way it is? You'd like it to move out of here today?
With the CS desk.
Okay. I move it to move out of committee with individual recommendation.
Okay, Representative Menard?
Just for discussion. Now, the position paper that we have where the administration is opposing it, that's taken care of in the committee substitute?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, motion carries. Thank you, everybody.
But we do just one thing before you guys do, and that's the contractor resolution that we've been trying to look at. We'd like to introduce this.
Which one?
Remember this. This is the one about relating to publicly funded construction projects bid by companies from other nations that don't allow American companies to
work. I like that.
We ran it by the Office of Foreign Trade, and we came up with a committee substitute that the governor's office signed off on, apparently.
My daughter put that bill together for Murkowski.
Okay.
Is that the Murkowski bill?
Is there any objection to introducing this as a committee bill?
No.
Okay. We'll proceed to introduce. Thank you, gentlemen. meeting is adjourned. And this bill thing signed.
You guys better support Ted.